From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Unfortunately, in this White House, we have warmongers and people like Jake Sullivan and Tony Blinken, who were had a very strong hand in being the architects of regime change wars in Iraq, in Libya, in Syria. Mm-hmm. And they're the ones who are influencing the decisions that are being made by this White House.
That was Tulsi Gabbard, former Democratic representative from Hawaii in the U.S. House of Representatives for four terms, speaking on a talk show this past Sunday about what's going on in Ukraine.
They are stoking tensions. They are escalating the situation that can only lead us down a more dangerous path that directly undermines the interests of the American people in our country. Let's be real about what we're dealing with here. We're talking about the United States and Russia, two great nuclear armed powers in the world. There is only one place that conflict ends. That ends in destruction of this world and life as we know it. Don't be naive. Don't be shy about pointing out exactly what is at stake. And that's what the American people need to know. And that's what people in the White House and leaders in Congress from both sides of the aisle refuse to tell them the truth about.
That was Tulsi Gabbard, representative in Congress from Hawaii, Democrat. It's a pretty somber note. You take it in the context of yesterday's joint maneuvers. This is a novelty also between the navies of Russia, China, and Iran. And can only say that this is a reflection of the mindset of the military strategists and politicians in Beijing and Moscow and Tehran, that they need to do this for their own self-defense. There's been also talk tied into our region among this, with the U.S. saying that they have the right to place troops at Russia's border in its quote-unquote allies like Ukraine. Reference has been made, suppose Cuba or Venezuela wants to start hosting the Russian or Chinese Navy for self-defense. And there was saber-rattling from Washington over that suggestion. And the whole game board right now seems to be in play and in a pretty scary place. And there are also, of course, some optimistic notes. And so we're going to have a chat with our friend Stephen Sefton in Nicaragua, taking a look at what's going on in our hemisphere from his vantage point. And Stephen, there's an awful lot going on right now, isn't there?
Yeah, thanks for inviting me to talk to you again, Don. And in the context of what Tulsi Gabbard was commenting and your remarks about what she said, and something quite important, certainly in the Central American and Caribbean region, and also many people think in an overall continental context, happened on early in November, and I don't think we've really had a chance to talk. Early in December, and we haven't really had a chance to talk about that.
Yeah, we haven't spoken since the week of Thanksgiving. So, yeah, this is our first time. Right. This is our first week back. So, go ahead. Let's definitely go there.
So early in December, Nicaragua recognized the People's Republic of China and cut all its relations with Taiwan.
Huge.
In accordance with the vast majority of other nations in the world, and that decision has had very strong regional repercussions, and is likely to have even continental repercussions in terms of its kind of ripple effect or knock-on effect. Currently, now, and I think only Guatemala, and I think Belize, continue to maintain relations with Taiwan. And China has been very, very emphatic in its and almost effusive in its response to Nicaragua's decision, and immediately provided something like a million vaccines of their Sinopharm, I think it's called, product to help people get some level of immunity against COVID-19. And they also immediately signed, practically immediately, signed a memorandum of understanding incorporating Nicaragua into China's Belt and Road program, which is a very big deal given Nicaragua's strategic position in the Central American isthmus, which is what has been the cause historically ever since the middle of the 19th century of the United States' obsession with Nicaragua, which it remains a tiny country in Central America, but one which the United States has persistently invaded and attacked one way or another over the last, getting on for what now, 170 years?
Yeah.
Since the invasion of William Walker back in 1856, I think it was. So that decision by Nicaragua to recognize China is a big deal, and it does come in this current extremely disturbing world context of the probability, in fact, the high probability of some kind of military conflict between Russia and the United States, and also further afield, the increasing probability, given United States actions, of some kind of conflict with China. Possibly over Taiwan itself.
Yeah, we almost had an ocean battle, you know, a battle on the seas yesterday, as a matter of fact, in the South China Sea.
Right. So, and that very powerful statement by Tulsi Gabbard that you played earlier is directly relevant for us here in the region, because despite the fact that the United States spokesperson commented in response to the suggestion that Russia might put some kind of military assets in Venezuela or Cuba, the fact is that Russia already has a military presence in Venezuela. Yeah. And Russia already has very strong military ties with Cuba. And China also has very strong relationships with Venezuela and Cuba, and also now with Nicaragua. And Nicaragua, for many years now, ever since Daniel Ortega and the Frente Sandinista, the Sandinista Front, took office after being 16 years out of power. They took office in January 2007. And ever since then, and one of the first things that happened back then was that they negotiated a transport deal with Russia and subsequently for the supply of buses that completely renovated Managua, Nicaragua's capital, completely renovated Managua's public transport system. And since then, since 2007 to date, that relationship has been consolidated with Russia through across a whole range of areas of national life in Nicaragua. From, for example, help with wheat imports, the installation of a vaccine production facility in Managua with under the Mechnikov Institute. An agreement that Nicaragua would host ground stations of what's the satellite system, the glass something, I've forgotten the name of the Russian satellite system,
right.
Nicaragua has a ground station for Russia's low orbit satellite system, GLONASS,
right, that's right, GLONASS.
They've had assistance with in other areas as well. In particular, the Russians have set up a training center in Nicaragua for the police across the Central American region to improve their skills in fighting organized crime. And so all those elements of cooperation between Russia and Nicaragua are ongoing. A couple of years ago, I think Russia sold to Nicaragua at a preferential price something like 70 upgraded T-72 tanks for their military. completely renewing Nicaragua's old Soviet-era tank fleet. And so, you know, in terms of current cooperation, that cooperation has existed between Russia and Venezuela and Cuba for a long time now. And now Nicaragua is joining Venezuela and Cuba in also being the beneficiary of a very close and strong development cooperation and commercial and technological exchange relationship with the People's Republic of China.
Right.
Similarly, it's worth bearing in mind, Don, that Iran, as you may remember, last year, Iran played a key role in assisting Venezuela recover its oil refining capacity.
Yes, I do. Yes.
There's currently, as I understand it, there's currently a small Iranian flotilla in the Atlantic precisely to protect any Iranian ships and tankers that may be traveling across the Atlantic towards Venezuela and Cuba. Nicaragua has hosted a couple of important visits by Iranian diplomats over the last couple of weeks. And it's worth pointing out that there were big delegations from China, Russia and Iran, also India and Syria, Vietnam, various countries from Asia and Africa as well, to the presidential inauguration that took place on January the 10th, that I was fortunate enough to be able to witness.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you saw an article recently by Ben Norton. Ben Norton of the Gray Zone, he wrote a very interesting article saying what you have been commenting on for in many conversations that we've had over the last couple of years, that whereas the United States claims that countries like Nicaragua or Russia or even China, for goodness sake, are isolated internationally, in fact, Ben points out, as you've noted yourself, that it's the United States and its allies that are increasingly isolated in the global context.
Yep.
And you could see that at the inauguration of President Daniel Ortega on January the 10th, when you had countries representing something like half the world's population,
right,
turning up for the presidential inauguration of a country of 6.5 million people.
I think we're going to see this again, by the way, in Beijing very shortly at the Olympics, with probably heads of state or other high officials of almost every country in the world except the United States for their boycott. I mean, I want to go to what we were talking about a minute ago, some of the things you were saying, because there's been some other recent developments along those same lines. First of all, increased commerce between Iran and Venezuela, and cooperation, particularly in oil and energy projects, has to be looked at move of joint naval maneuvers between Russia, China, and Iran. You have to consider the commerce between Iran and Venezuela on the high seas within that context, where the U.S. has sanctions that it's attempted to, that it's legally, from under its own law, imposed on both Iran and Venezuela. And the commerce between them, according to U.S. Sanctions, is illegal, certainly a pretext for some sort of, attempt to board or interdict or quarantine that kind of naval activity. And you're seeing that, in essence, China, Russia, and Iran providing themselves the military, the naval infrastructure to defend their right of navigation. That's a really important thing that's going on there. And another thing that's happened in the last few days is that Venezuela has made arrangements with a number of African oil producers. They're basically building a cartel that already includes Iran. And so you're sort of seeing like an OPEC-style cartel being assembled without the United States or its puppet regimes like Saudi Arabia, unless they come in on the same terms that the others come in. And again, this is another area of isolation.
Right. Yeah, and that whole discussion leads to the question of when, because I think it is a question of when, not if, Nicaragua finally decide, and China finally go ahead and build the interoceanic canal,
right,
in the southern part of Nicaragua.
Yep.
And what that is a huge strategic challenge to the United States, because they've always regarded the Caribbean as what the Romans used to call the Mediterranean, the our sea, the right, Mare Nostrum.
Right. That's right, Mare Nostrum.
And that's, you know, and if China and Nicaragua take the decision to go ahead with the canal, and that'll happen very quickly, the Chinese, that kind of Chinese technological project happens very, very quickly. No, and it'll, and if they start building, it'll probably be done in 3-4 years. But even if they don't go ahead with the canal, just let's assume that they don't go ahead with the canal. I mean, what Nicaragua has been doing quietly over the last 5 or 6 years, ever since the original plans for the canal were announced back in 2013, I think it was, via Hong Kong proxy, essentially a proxy for the People's Republic of China, a company called HKMD, led by a quite a well-known business person called Wang Jing. And he was always regarded, without any proof, as being a proxy for the People's Republic of China in its government. And now we can see that that's, no, and that phase is over, and now the People's Republic of China is openly an ally, a commercial, economic, and technological ally of Nicaragua, which is that in itself is a huge challenge for the United States. But and what Nicaragua's done over the last few years is it's invested very astutely in infrastructure that connects the Caribbean coast of the country with the Pacific coast, with highways, with the electricity, with internet connections, and so they've actually, and they're also in the process of doing feasibility studies on for new ports on both on the Caribbean coast and the Pacific coast,
right.
And all that preparatory work could be the prelude, and almost certainly is the prelude, to some kind of dry canal.
Right.
Even if the actual interoceanic canal doesn't happen.
Right. I mean, this is a knock on it. Whether if they build the canal or not, these things have intrinsic value in sort of accomplishing the same goal, which is to tie the two coasts together. And to use it as a channel, a tunnel, an avenue of trade between the Pacific and the Caribbean.
Yeah, if China installs a railway from there used to be a railway in Nicaragua from the port of Corinto, which is Nicaragua's main port on the Pacific coast, all the way down to I think it ran as far as Chontales, right in the central highlands of Nicaragua. For China to install a railway uniting the Pacific and Caribbean coasts, uniting port infrastructure and so on, and perhaps even developing, there's a military airport north of Managua that not many people know about, but it actually has, I think it's actually bigger, as big as the Soto Cano Air Base in Honduras, the runway. And there have been plans for many years that have been mooted to turn that into Nicaragua's main international airport, but they've never had the investment or the other infrastructure necessary to make that a sensible thing to do. But now that they have this relationship with China, that may well happen too. So, and all that infrastructure development means that the connection the between the Pacific and Caribbean coasts will open up the Caribbean to the flow of Chinese trade into the Atlantic. And that just completely changes the game in terms of certainly Cuba's economic options and the economic options for the Caribbean generally.
And for Nicaragua, by the way, I mean, it makes Nicaragua essentially the retailer of China's goods to the Caribbean in a way. I mean, they come through here. So there's some kind of a value for having that kind of commerce go through your country, and this again, you're building already the infrastructure to support it, which on its own is a fundamental improvement to the capital base of the country, and it's another example of just what the Sandinistas have done to build the country to develop the country for the people.
Absolutely, Don, and it'll complete the. The main objective, the main political objective of the government of Daniel Ortega is to lift Nicaragua's population out of poverty. And that's what they're doing together with China. Now, the question that I have that I haven't seen anybody else talk about is China prepared to make the investment in security terms to protect the vast investments that they're, or relatively vast in Nicaragua's in terms, that they're making in Nicaragua. And the United States is not going to sit back and just let that happen.
I don't see the very astute planners in China, you know, who, for example, would be deciding what kind of investment to make in this project, doing it without satisfying themselves that the project is secure from that perspective.
Right.
And you have a unity of identity in China between finance and the military, for example, that you don't really have anywhere else in the world on that scale. And so, you know, I don't see the construction company going into the bank in China and saying, we want to build this, without somebody saying to the military, can you guys protect it? And unless they say yes and prove it in the same way you'd have to prove you can pay a loan back if you went down to borrow $100 at the bank, they said, I just don't, they're not reckless. They're the opposite of reckless. And so I think if that happens, they're going to have assured themselves that they can protect it.
Yeah, so and I think what that means in terms of geopolitical developments in the region, in terms of Nicaragua, Venezuela, and Cuba in particular, is that we're likely to see very careful, cautious moves by the Chinese and Russia and Iran, and those three countries. Am I right in saying that Iran is now openly discussing with Russia a strategic, a 20-year strategic plan?
Yeah, you just had a summit meeting. Was it yesterday or the day before yesterday between the presidents of the two countries? They are discussing everything, and including, by the way, this takes place within the context of the development of the Belt and Road project. So that's the Eurasian Development Project in essence. That's the southern tier of it. And so I don't know what they spoke about behind closed doors, but I don't see why else they would meet.
Right, and of course, and also in the case of China and Iran, they recently negotiated, last year I think it was, they inked a 50-year strategic development plan. And so you have China, Russia, and Iran making all these plans and programs and strategic to implement their strategic vision for their peoples, for their economies, for their security. And it's just extremely unlikely that in the conversations that the representatives of those three countries are having in Nicaragua, and China now has an embassy in Managua, they opened it up last month, it's extremely unlikely that they are not paying very close attention indeed to particularly that security issue in terms of their investment in Nicaragua. Absolutely. And also Venezuela and Cuba. And obviously, we don't know what, as you say, we have no idea what's being said in the conversations, but and it would be extremely unusual for them not to be setting out a strategy to be able to address potential United States aggression, economic or otherwise.
That's right, of course. All right, so we've got, I mean, that's the historical context. That's always waiting. You assert yourself and they come along, you know, with gunboats and whatever. We've got about 3 minutes, 3.5 minutes left. And what I wanted to do was maybe step out for a second, take a look at the overall context there. You've got a situation in Central America with Xiomara Castro, you know, about to take office. President Ortega was inaugurated last week. I know you were present there along with some of our friends. Next month there's elections in Costa Rica. The elections right now in Barbados seem to be swinging along with the progressive forces. Just in general, you know, we've had that ebb and flow of the so-called pink tide, as the knuckleheads at the Times referred to it. It looks like the tide is coming in right now.
Yeah, and the two, probably all those elections are important, in particular Xiomara taking office in Honduras, which is a very big deal also in here in Central America. But perhaps more importantly for the wider region are the elections in Colombia, which has legislative elections in March and presidential elections in May. And of course, the biggest country in
Brazil, yeah.
Latin America, Brazil, has its elections in October, which right. If Lula manages to stay in good health until then, he's practically bound to win. And in Colombia, you have the advance of, in Colombian terms, progressive forces in the form of, he was a former mayor of Bogota, Gustavo Petro. And it looks likely that he is likely to do very well in the presidential elections and perhaps to the point of becoming president himself. But what that means is that in the legislative elections in March, we can expect a national legislature with a radically different configuration of forces and power to what we've been used to over the last decade. I think these elections will mark the end of the era of Álvaro Uribe and his narco-terrorist gangster cronies.
Wouldn't that be something? After 60-something years of that stuff, really. You know, we've had some reversals, of course. What's going on in Mexico is not quite as optimistic looking as it was a year or two ago. Of course, the U.S. has been very busy there. You have to, you know, assume that. And Bolivia is still definitely some contradictions still on the ground there. They did reverse the coup, but the other side is not giving up yet. And so there's a lot of struggle.
Right. Yeah, and the U.S. is still obviously an extremely important influence, essentially a negative influence across the board in Latin America, and they've been relatively successful over the last 4 or 5 years in kind of spoiling and preventing the development of the progressive options that do radically change the lives of the impoverished majority in the region. But it looks as though increasingly, they're likely to be less successful.
One last thing, just to note it for folks. I saw the day before yesterday, President Maduro at Venezuela saying, last year, Venezuela's GDP grew by 4%, which I think is higher than the U.S., which I think was at 2.5% last year.
Yeah.
And so...
CEPAL, the UN body, the Economic Commission for Latin America and the Caribbean, just produced their preliminary report on 2021 for the Latin American region, and they say that overall the region grew about 6% last year, it's likely to grow between 2 and 3% in 2022. So, in those terms, Venezuela looks as though it did very well, almost achieving the regional average, which, given the conditions that it suffered for the last 7, 8, 9 years is an incredible achievement.
And thank you so much, Stephen. We'll speak with you again next week.
Okay, thanks a million, Don. Look forward to it.
Thank you. You too.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.